Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. You join us on this fine Scottish day. Is the sun shining where you are, Ricky?
It was, but today was also the coldest day on record for something like 25 years, 30 years on this day here in
on
Scotland.
On this day, I was going to say, it's about 13 degrees. It gets colder than this in Scotland.
No, on this day.
But on this particular
day.
The
25th of September. This has been the coldest of September for about 25, 30 years.
Ugh, there you go, you learn something new every day.
You know why? Because hell has frozen over and we have finally managed to get the two guys from Harage on a podcast.
It's remarkable.
It is.
It's amazing.
It's a year in the making.
Is that the excuse we're taking?
Yes.
Well, I was going to say, it's been a year on the wrist, so it seems to be about right. For the watch that I still have that belongs to these gentlemen. I'm not sure if, I mean, there must be a point at which you write it off as a stock loss, presumably, and we'll introduce...
A rounding error.
Rounding error, yes. Like, you know, if you know, that's, I think that seems perfectly reasonable. Anyway, we're joined by Landon and Andy.
Don't get watches more, will you, Lenore?
Yeah, like, all right, so you think I owe you more money now that a year has passed? There's definitely some Scottish blood in you somewhere. Anyway, we welcome Andy and Landon from the watch company normally known as Porridge, but for the sake of this podcast, we'll call it Harage, which is actually its proper name. How are you, gentlemen?
Yeah, very well. We are not with you in Scotland. That's a big problem because I'm missing my sticky toffee pudding.
Ooh. And your fish suppers.
We have tried our best. We tried to get you guys across and then you couldn't travel. And I tried to come across twice. And our Nicola Sturgeon decided that she was going to ground me and wouldn't allow me to fly places. It was terrible.
They actually moved the border of a country to stop Ricky coming to see you by saying that actually you lived in France and not Switzerland or Germany or wherever it is they actually are. I've never quite understood it.
It was horrible.
But there we go.
Horrible. Anyway. But anyway, you're here now, guys, so that's the main thing that counts.
Yeah, no, it's really good to be back. And yeah, we've talked a lot over the year, but... yeah, unfortunately, those travel plans didn't work out, but at least with the gift of the internet, we are still staying connected.
Indeed, yes. We are. Now, we should probably do a wrist check, right? Because we don't really do them much.
No, I think we've managed to forget them for the past couple of episodes.
Hmm.
So
past couple of dozen episodes.
So, I mean, it's a question as to whether I can see. The thing is, if I say I'm wearing the Harage, then A, it seems like I'm crawling. B, it lets them know I've still got it, and you know that causes problems. So I'm just going to say I'm wearing the Panerai, although that the Harage might be really, really close to where I'm sitting, possibly at the end of my arm. But other than that, I'm wearing a Panerai. No, the Harage Autarch, which frankly is still here because I still love it, but just don't have enough money to buy it. So maybe we'll do a deal.
I have the feeling that you wear my Panerai, which was stolen some 10 years ago.
Oh, you think that's what it is? You think I'm just going around stealing all your watches? What other watches have you lost recently?
What I lost or?
Or stolen?
All of our watches were stolen some years ago.
No, not guilty. Not guilty. Were you in Scotland at the time?
No, really. All our sample watches were stolen.
Oh, all the sample watches. I seem to recall a story of you having like a watch from way back that was stolen. I didn't realize all your sample watches were stolen. Well, I've got one of them, so you can have that one back if you like. If you've forgotten,
the funny thing, we talked about that before. I don't collect watches. Mm-hmm. I make them.
Oh, I collect them and don't make them. So there you go. It's a marriage made in heaven.
We should continue with the wrist check, I think.
It's a partnership. So what are you wearing, Andy?
Ricky?
Oh, is it me? I was wanting you guys because you're the guests.
Okay, I'm the guest. You know, I'm wearing what you would like to have, a prototype.
Uh-huh.
An Autarch prototype.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, is this by any chance got not a really, really big rotor in it, but maybe a little dinky rotor in it?
No. It's an upgrade from the regular Autarch 10 years.
Oh.
With a blue brush dial and full supernova numerals. It's a killer watch.
So do you take trade-ins? Because I've got an old Autarch here, which I feel like upgrading.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
We've entered Scotland.
We have. So tell us more about this watch then. When's it coming out? Is it available soon, now, next year?
We are arguing heavily. to be honest. There's a lot of arguing going on internally. Everybody wants to wear things, and that takes a little time. Yeah.
And I need to photograph things. So yeah. Andy is doing what he's not supposed to be doing, is wearing a watch before it's actually been photographed as a daily wear.
But since there's Photoshop.
That's it. That's his excuse. It's like, you can fix it in Photoshop. Like,
wow. Did we not hear this kind of reasoning from you when you came over to do the talk show? It was, you know, this tourbillon is like a prototype. No one is supposed to be wearing it because we haven't done the shots yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my wife's getting angry. You remember that?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. good. Yeah,
she gets angry, and then I get angry, but I'm not allowed to be angry because I'm the guy making the photos.
Correct. So roughly when will this one be out then, do you reckon?
Well, we're working on things right now. As far as the prototypes are concerned, they've arrived. So there's a couple other colors as well. Mm-hmm. And we've also changed some of the material base within the watch as well. So we are currently working on a little bit of a program. We're going to have our first ever happy hour. And we have a select few pieces of the Autarch that Rick has, you know, had on loan for the last year, as well as another dial version, the Rhodium dial. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a sort of end of that generation happy hour where people can come. And as soon as they're gone, and they'll be at a one-time sort of reduced price for our enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. And then we'll move into generation two, which Andy's wearing, and yeah, we'll launch that probably in the springtime.
Excellent. Cool. All right. And Landon, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing the Autarch 10-year with bracelet.
Am I the only guy that isn't wearing an Autarch today? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That kind of the story. Right. Okay. Is this you getting me back because I didn't like the watch?
That's right.
What do you mean? No. It's,
you're all ganging up on me.
Yeah, exactly. You're not part of the team here. Come on.
Sod you guys.
So, no, I was just returning back, and it was in to have a little bit of a bracelet upgrade. Uh-huh. And I was hoping I was actually going to get the leather strap that Andy's wearing, but there's only a few of those. And so I gotta settle with that.
Married to the boss.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I guess the way it goes.
I managed to get my hands on the Autarch about a couple of weeks ago there because Rick dropped off a box of watches that he has been squirreling away for a rainy day, apparently, to do reviews on, which are now starting to flow after a year. So I had the Autarch out and I was getting some shots of it, put a couple on Instagram, put a couple on our Facebook page. And you know what? It's not quite as out there as I remember it being. I don't know if I've softened up in the last year, but yeah, I might have to eat my own words. It's not that bad, actually.
I can do a good deal on a used one.
Yeah, well, it's got all that kind of arm hair caught in it and wrist cheese, so you're going to have to give it a deep clean. Today, I am wearing something that isn't made from you guys, unfortunately, but it is something of, well, it's a good value watch, which is what your ones are, and this is the Christopher Ward Super Compressor. So I've been playing around with this one. We have got an episode recorded with Nick from Fears Watches, who actually knows the guys at Christopher Ward. You know, he goes out and has lunches and whatnot with Mike France occasionally, and we got him to do a kind of introductory talk on this one, plus another Christopher Ward that we've got in for review at the moment. So I'm trying this one out. My lady friend had a look at it when she was over, and she actually really likes it, which is strange because, as we discussed before, she doesn't really have much taste when it comes to watches. Obviously, fantastic taste in men.
Some might say.
Christopher Ward's good. I mean, they are neighbours down here in Beale.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Engineering and movement making place here.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah, sure. It's an engineering company which was integrated or taken over some time ago.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they are probably beeline 1 kilometer away from this microphone.
Oh, right. There you go. Well, that makes up for all the people on Instagram that said that their watches were made in a sweatshop in China.
We got followed by Christopher Ward today. The actual Christopher Ward.
It could be that other brand that's borrowing graphic design cues from them.
Oh, you saw that, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did have a little bit of fun on Instagram there with that.
I think it's the first time I've seen Bremont and Christopher Ward interact in a civil way for a while.
Yeah, that was really strange. One of the English brothers, one of the founders of Bremont, came on to one of the memes that I put up and said, yeah, that happened to us too. Jesus Christ.
So, but it's very cool. I mean, it's a complete... I mean, it's not like you could be vaguely inspired. It's just a carbon copy or as close as
hopeless.
They can get.
The thing is, I put another image up on our Facebook group showing the differences between the render that Invicta mm-hmm. put out for this thing. You know, I've said before, I quite like some Invictas, not all of them, but some of them are mm-hmm. decent. But this one, the render looked exactly like the Christopher Ward. The actual for sale version of the Invicta looked shocking.
Was that right? So,
yeah, oh, horrible. You should know, you should be in our Facebook group.
Well, I should pay attention.
Yes, yes, you should.
But we actually got followed by the real Christopher Ward, who's no longer at Christopher Ward, who has a new company.
Well, is it his? Because I've heard it's not his. I heard it's his kids.
No. Well, I think I suspect it's. Would probably be vaguely accurate to say it might be funded by Daddy to some extent. Right. You would think that if your father was once significantly involved in a watch company and you set up a watch company, that your father may have something to do with it. I'd ask Ed Moser. I'll tell you all about it.
Guess what? Most of the watch brands only survive because they have fathers. Rich fathers. Mm-hmm. <Yeah.
laughs> So this is a case of Christopher Ward is keeping his watchmaking company for the next generation?
Yes, yes. So by making watches exclusively for Liverpool, not exclusively, but for Liverpool Football Club.
Yeah. I saw mm-hmm. that.
So there okay. we go. I can't remember what it is. Is it Tribus watches or something they're called? Anyway,
Tribus.
Tribus. I have to say, I thought they looked quite expensive for what they are, but there you go. If you like that kind of thing. Yes. Anyway, that's kind of off. But the idea that the watch company survived because of rich parents. So go on then, Andy, name and shame. We'll bleep it out.
Sometimes they're probably not parents, but they are some other.
Sugar daddy
kind of thing.
What sugar daddies? We've not spoken about them in a while.
That's been a while. That's been about 150
episodes. Some of them
episodes.
Are called investors, but they are probably sugar daddies. Yeah. We talked about that last time.
Yes.
I think Len and we talked about it, that most of the watch companies need such long funding that they actually, they need someone in the background. You need 10 years to get it off the ground, mm-hmm. at least.
Yeah, the buying decision just doesn't happen today. Somebody sees a watch and they say, okay, I really want to buy that watch, unless they're completely, minted. But for the most part, these buying decisions take 6 months to a year to come to fruition. And if you're only doing a few of those every so often, it takes a long time for a brand to get some legs.
Yeah.
And therefore, in that time, they have, you see some of the ways that they work with at in the past at fairs. As well as in marketing and in media, and they're not frugal about their budgets, and so they need to have somebody to fund those things in the background.
Uh-huh. And the founder always thinks it goes faster, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always this thing that okay, next year this is going to be our year, but the thing is, it just takes an extremely long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody thinks my watch is the best one.
Yeah,
I mean it's like with the kids, you know.
Yeah. It's the ugly baby syndrome. They want to share photos of their kids on Facebook and everyone's like, Jesus Christ.
Exactly. Yeah. And everybody can have a baby, but not everybody should be having a baby. It's the same in the watch world. Anybody can open up InDesign and design a watch, but not everybody should design a watch.
You're very true. I mean, I keep saying this to Rick's parents all the time.
I was about to make a joke there that would lose a significant part of our audience, so I'm going to refrain.
Right, okay, let's write this ship a little bit then. So before we go too far in, because we do have a lot of new listeners that we've accumulated over the last half year, there might be some people that have never heard of Raj, they've never heard of any of the podcasts we've done before, they've not seen the talk show episode. So can you guys give us the sort of 60-second elevator pitch of what a Raj is and what it is you guys do?
Orange is a brand located in Biel, Switzerland, heartland of watchmaking. We started the brand in 2008, and then we actually worked on our movement, which is the K1 movement. So we have an independent source for our movements inside of the watches. And we team size. We are all together, I would say, 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we more or less do all our stuff by ourselves.
Yeah, so we have not only the brand Orage, which Andy and his wife Sue had formed, but we also have our engineering firm, which is called The Plus or THE Plus. And at the engineering firm is where all the IP is stored for K1, our future movements in the tourbillon world, as well as K2, which is the micro rotor as well.
Perfect. And a quick run through of the watches you guys currently have, because from memory and from the talk show video, they all look very, very different. So So we'll include some details in the show notes, but can you give us a quick run through?
So we have the array, which comes in three different colors. So we have the black, the white, and the gray. And it's inspired by the early pioneers of the watch industry that spent the winters making watches and spending the summers farming. Then we also have the Autark, which Autark translates from German into independence. And it was a piece that really showcased our K1 movement because it was the first watch that we made or that housed our K1 movement and really stood for our stance as an independent watchmaker. Mm-hmm. Then we have Omnium is the other piece, which is like a, it's a timeless classic piece. And not saying timeless that it doesn't have time, but it has a lot of great attributes to it. And it was our first watch that was made. It first came out in a solid gold, 18 karat gold.
At this
version.
Time with ETA?
At that time with an ETA. And then Andy realized that, okay, this movement supplier thing could be an issue in the future and decided to go down the road of developing an in-house movement. So the brand was actually put on ice at that time for the most part. And it went into movement development. So Omnium is a really unique piece in that it has this facet cut sapphire crystal on it. And the lug finishing on it is absolutely superb. It is something that when you first look at it, you think, okay, that's a nice watch. And then it catches your eye again and it just pulls you into the details.
Only for insiders.
Yeah.
That's the watch for the experts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we have SolarWind. Which is one, Ricky, that you actually approve of.
yes.
And SolarWind is it's something very unique in that it's made with a meteorite dial.
That's the one you stole from Area 51 when we did the raid a couple of years back.
Exactly. Yeah. So Andy broke in. He went on a covert op and pulled SolarWind out of Area 51. But it's got the meteorite dial and the case itself looks like an impact crater. It's really something truly unique. It's a piece of art.
Yeah.
For the most part.
And then we have Multiply.
And then we have Multiply, yeah.
As the name says.
Yeah.
It has a lot of versions. You can configure the dials, the functions, the straps. And it has a, I would say, a more German look from when you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can see the kind of... would it be offensive to reference Nomos with the really...
No.
Straightforward big date multipliers.
If you take the Omnium and you reference it to Nomos, I would say Nomos with a little bit more balls.
Okay, fair enough. That's fine.
That's the best that'll work for it.
I think that'll work quite well in the advert. Nomos with dangly bits.
Yes.
So,
I mean, from a designer's point of view, if you dare to do something like Omnium, but when you look at it, this watch, this Omnium watch was the first watch. And we asked our designer, what kind of watch would you make if you make it for yourself?
Right.
And the result is Omnium. And she is in the business for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Good. And from there, you have some kind of tourbillon thing as well?
Ah, yeah, we forgot that.
Yeah. That exists.
That exists. Good stuff. Perfect.
Seems that we have too many watches already. We are forgetting some of them.
Yeah, we're getting caught up in the future, I think.
But I think you can never have too many watches.
No. It's been well over half a year since we actually sat down. It's been well over half a year since we were able to sit down. And a hell of a lot has changed since you came over to Scotland, did the talk show with us, got the video released, and then had the meetup afterwards with all the watch enthusiasts. So take us through then, sort of February, March, April, through the summer. What's been happening? Give us the updates.
We were lucky because after we visited Glasgow, we were able to travel before that nasty virus thing was
taken. You went across to the east, didn't you?
Yeah. We wanted to make a tour actually also to China, but then China seemed too dangerous already and we had to skip Hong Kong also, but we went to Taiwan. And in Taiwan, we had meetings with a lot of watch enthusiasts and we learned something about COVID and how to deal with it. So there was no lockdown. There was people who are aware of how to deal with wearing a mask and without the whole pain which we experienced when we were coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent some good time in Taiwan, and from Taiwan we went to Singapore, met a watch club, met a lot of people there. And we during this period, we sold quite a lot of tourbillons, surprisingly. And we thought we could sell much more, obviously, but we couldn't go to the other countries which we were planning, like US and more in Europe, because then when we were coming back, there was a lockdown.
Yeah.
And this was a little bit of an issue. But since we were in Taiwan, it was very easy for us to deal with it because everybody knew, okay, what do you have to do and how to deal with masks. And the whole panic was a little bit surprising to us. We didn't went into short labor like half of Europe and especially the entire Swiss watch industry. Instead, we beefed up our engineering power and said, okay, full speed ahead. Let's make better products, new products, and continue to communicate and get more into the social media communication. I mean, I did a little bit of Instagram live and all the things we have done, or everybody was doing at this time. And yeah, and then when the whole thing was loosening up, we thought that we start to get into production with our tourbillon, and then somehow the whole supplier relationship disintegrated and we had to decide to make the whole movement by ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what we have done.
Yeah, we covered this on our show, and I think, Landon, were you on one of our lives as well?
Yeah.
So we did, we've kind of explained a little bit about that, but the way we see things and the way that the people we speak to, our audience and everybody we interact with, is coming out the other side of it, you guys have now got a far better product at the same price or thereabouts, so the consumer is going to win, even though there's like a marginal delay of maybe a month or two. So what are the changes then that you guys have implemented from what we saw back in January, February time to how things are going now?
Yeah, well, the actual movement itself is there's nothing taken from the previous movement before. Everything is completely engineered from the ground up again. We sold that watch with a specific aesthetic look to it, right? And so we needed to retain that as much as possible. And so the bridges, which are our design, will remain sort of the same look, but we had to move some of the locations of the jewels around to accommodate the inner workings of the movement. So we've developed the entire geometry of the gear train, the silicone escapement. Everything is completely engineered specifically for the tourbillon itself. So we've re-engineered all the geometries that are used in the gear train, which is something quite unique. It's nothing's pulled off the shelf from anywhere. As well as we've made a tourbillon cage that is significantly lower profile and lighter and obviously more efficient than what the customers were going to get before. The previous cage was at 5.6 millimeters, and we're at 3.9 millimeters. So we shaved off a ton from the height, and we're using a bearing system as well within the cage, which is different than what we had before with the jewel construction. So there is it's nothing.
It's a new movement
at all, like it was before, and it's getting 100 plus hours in our calculations, and we have parts starting to show up in the THE Plus now.
Already, stuff coming in.
Yeah, today I was photographing the main barrel, and we have some other parts coming in as well this week too. So it's a pretty exciting time to see what we started in pretty much June-ish, June, because that's when we told the world about it. And now we're in, we're in
September. I mean, we had a war. We had an engineering war going on. internally,
right?
Because in the beginning, when we were starting to think about in-housing the whole engineering exercise, then Jonas was like freaking out, are you crazy? You can't do that in this time. And then I said, I mean, what is the option? Shouldn't we just trust in our team and let's make sure we put the young people at work and you make sure that they do the right things in the right way? And so for us, it was not only just a new movement. It was an excellent exercise to motivate a team and bring them together and do know-how transfer from the workhorse Jonas,
who's our CEO of the
rugby-playing watchmaking monster, into the other people who are in the team who do not yet have this deep know-how. And this was and the motivation went through the roof.
Yeah.
And so we were capable to do that within 2 months.
Yeah. And the reason why was, I guess, we had this internal battle of whether to do it or not is because we have an entirely other movement in the works at the moment too. Mm-hmm. And there are very few brands that come to market or are within the same year developing two movements, especially from a young, smaller group like ours, to take on these two very, very big movement projects.
So you have at the moment the K1 movement, which is the K, are there any watches that don't have the K1 movement in it that you're using ETAs or Solitaires or anything off the shelf, or is everything K1 based?
Everything K1 based.
So all the watches that you can see on your website just now are K1 based. Yes. You then have the Tourbillon coming along, which will be, well, there, thereabouts. And then is the one I'm particularly excited about is the K2, which is your micro rotor movement. So when will we first see that in the flesh?
So K2 is a, in the flesh is a good question. Currently, we have parts coming in for K2, so we're just working with our developing the prototype right now. Cool. As far as the program around K2 is concerned, we are looking at bringing it to market in two different channels, so a B2B channel and a B2C channel. And so we're currently working on the business models for both of those, and we're looking at launching K2 to the consumer world sometime in November.
Mm.
And will that be in pre-existing cases and models that we're familiar with, but just with this as a movement, or will it be brand new design of watches that go along with the K2 movement?
A lot of arguing going on here.
So you can imagine, developing a Tourbillon and then developing a movement and then working on what the future watch or the first watch that will have K2 in it. Mm-hmm. Will be is it's we will have it as a sort of a multi-tier program, whereas the movement itself will act as a deposit on the future watch that will come. So individuals can purchase the movement, and if they'd like to just have the movement shipped to them because they love looking at movements, we'll happily ship it to them. But if they want to keep that with us until the watch design is completed, then they'll be able to have their movement placed within that watch design. And the watch design will be will present a number of designs to the market and enable them to share their feedback and be a part of deciding on what the final watch will look like.
Right, okay.
Probably there might be two versions, because I guess there might be an internal set version.
There might be three versions.
Yeah, I mean, well, might be three versions. But our girls, they have an opinion on how a watch should look like.
Yeah. So what Andy really means is that no matter how everybody votes from the great consumer, there's then the one that he wants to have made. Yep. Is that what we're saying?
I was reading this Isochrono text yesterday. Was it yesterday?
Yeah, Isochrono put out an article on it.
And then I was reading about how the hell are we cool doing three movements? I mean, just 4 years ago, I said we only do one. We stick with K1. Mm-hmm. But out of a sudden, we find ourselves with a Tourbillon movement and now with a K2. And somehow that's because we can do it.
And do you view the K2 movement as going to be something that's more dress watch or formal watch?
What are the differences between them for listeners?
Between the two movements?
Yeah.
The movement is much flatter. It's a micro rotor 2.9 millimeter. That's probably only one competing product in the market.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's more likely to be in kind of precious metal watches or more formal dress watches, and you keep the K2?
Do you speculate on the future sample?
Well,
What do you want to have? What would you like to? What would happily replace that Panerai?
What would replace the Panerai? Well, that's a very good question. It's a very good question. So 42 mil at least. So my Panerai is 44. Anything below 42 just looks too small. My eyes need to adjust. Mm-hmm. So we'll have something in 42 mil. I wouldn't mind it if it had a bezel bit of stainless steel, mm-hmm. a stainless steel bezel or an aluminium bezel, none of this ceramic nonsense, something that will wear over time, mm-hmm. And a wee micro rotor. If you happen to be able to squeeze a GMT hand in there somewhere, I think that's the next stage, you need a GMT movement. Then that
you
were
pretty
fine.
Much spot on.
I knew there was a reason you gave me this watch as part payment for my design input.
in any case, we will be on the slim side.
Right.
So it will be a very wearable thing when you look at it from the height. Because when you have a 2.9 millimeter movement, and of course a GMT needs will be a little bit thicker, we will make something very slim and very comfortable to wear. And in I personally, I mean, you know, mechanically sports watches are a strange definition of a sports watch.
Yes.
When you do a sports watch, you wear a Garmin or what, something like that. Mm-hmm. But when we look at this casual sports look, that's probably what we are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so is there, what would be the decision over what you would put a K2 movement in versus a K1? Like what is there a
why
reason,
we did that?
So is there a reason why you wouldn't, now you've got the K2 movement, why would you not just fit it to everything? Because a micro rotor is cool.
The more expensive.
Is it just a cost?
No,
matter?
I'm, you know, the problem with K1 is, it was designed to be the bread and butter machine for a brand. Okay. So you can run a product lineup like we have it now, and we do that with one movement, and you are very well equipped. But it is designed in a way that it is not sandwich modularity enabled, I would say.
Right.
So you can't, it doesn't make sense to build stuff on top.
Aha.
And that's why we always knew since 2016, roughly, that we will need something complementary which allows building modules on top. I wouldn't say chronographs right now, but who knows?
But that's the whole idea about going with a micro rotor, is that you have a very, very slim base profile that allows for these modules to be put on top of it. And as Andy said, K1 was designed to already have a certain level of modularity built into it. Mm-hmm. You can do 18 different variations with it, and you remain with the same case profile, same case size. So it's a way of helping brands. K1 was a way of helping brands reduce costs through their case inventories. And be able to scale with their bread and butter pieces. K2 is an evolution of that, of taking the industrial aspect of K1 and marrying it with more of a manufacturer modularity and also the decoration. The K2 is also very beautiful as well.
I mean, bread and butter sounds a little bit disrespectful from my side, but if we want to reduce the rich daddy problem, we need something in the base.
The workhorse.
Yeah,
that's the workhorse. That's it. But if you want to go more advanced on the function side, which inevitably comes down the road of a brand's mm-hmm. lifetime, then you need something where you can put modules on top. And if you already have a movement which is 4.95 or 5 millimeter high and you put stuff on top, the watches just don't look good from the side view in future because the winding stem is going down.
Yep.
I mean, that's a typical problem of the ETA, Zelita module top building thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why we shot for the really advanced micro rotor stuff, because you have a very thin thing from the beginning.
My first question is, so you talked briefly about chronographs there and the fact that you've got two watch movements on the go just now. If you were to wander into your engineering workshop this afternoon and say, guys, I've just been on to the Scottish Watches Guide doing a podcast and they think chronographs is the way forward, we're going to build a chronograph, how many of them would down tools and walk out if you decided that as well as a tourbillon and a micro rotor, now we're building a chronograph?
Yeah, well, I mean, K2 could, in essence, help with that. That side of the conversation. It's just right now we're working on making sure that the movements that we're involved in are
stable. I mean, seriously, we are taking on, we have made a movement. We are capable of doing micro rotors, which you usually see in watches north of 10,000 Swiss francs. Yep. We master that. We know that. We have proven that we will make an excellent tourbillon, which is meant to be the holy grail of watchmaking when it comes to movement business. But the true holy grail, in my opinion, is a chronograph. That's super hardcore. And of course, I would love to do that, but it needs a bunch of people doing nothing else than designing and building that stuff for 3 to 5 years. So if you guys help us to raise a lot of cash through your community, I'm more than happy to hire more engineers.
Okay. Well, I mean, Ricky's looking for a job and we all know he's a master watchmaker at heart.
That's
if
it.
There's magnets involved,
you're welcome.
He'll be over there. So no, I mean, you're right though. It is underappreciated that actually when you speak to watchmakers, they'll tell you the real, you know, difficult stuff would be building a chronograph from the ground up. And Tourbillon's sold last week. But there we go. So my second question then is, it's quite clear that during the whole lockdown, COVID, et cetera, you guys have decided to accelerate rather than, you know, gird your loins, sit back and just see how things shake out. How do you view what the rest of the Swiss watch industry has done during lockdown? Obviously, a lot of folk have furloughed people. A lot of places have closed. A lot of people have sat back. Some brands haven't. The likes of Rolex, Tudor all appear to have pushed on. What's your reflections on how this particular crisis is going to affect the Swiss watch industry and indeed the near German industry going forward?
I think nearly every watch brand went into short labor. Everyone, also the big ones. And they are to a certain degree still in that state. The big guys, they have a lot of cash. They wouldn't have had to do that. So I have my questions on that. If this is really needed, do you really need, as a company who has billions on the account, to use the money and go for a long holiday? I think that's questionable. When it comes to us, our decision was very clear. No short labor, invest in engineering, try to do new interesting stuff. Because I think it's dangerous to put a company to sleep. And some of the brands and the companies today, they recognize, oh shit, that's a big problem. Our company doesn't really function anymore. The people have been off work for 3 months, 4 months. I mean, just imagine, go for holiday for 3 months and then you come back to work and you, until you function again, that's a big issue. So I think that's not a very smart way to be in this year. And it creates fear among employees. I think that was not a good idea.
And how do you think that will shake out going forwards? I mean, what will the consequences of that be, do you think? Will it be at a brand level, a retail level, a consumer level?
Yeah. I mean, some of the brands probably will go out of business and then they find a new rich daddy and they will be revived.
Always a bit the rich daddies. Always the rich daddies.
the industry works like that.
Yeah.
I think retailing has been in transformation before already. Everybody knows that the world is also not only online. That's also nothing new. The companies manage to do more digitization. So they, out of a sudden, we can have team meetings, which were impossible before. So that was a good sign that some of the watch managers understand that's possible to use the internet. And I think in general, the fundamental issue of the industry is that it produced too much before already. And COVID just showed brutally that this is not a good idea. And so I hope we will have a more healthy watch industry afterwards, which delivers better value, which communicates more directly to the clients, and we probably see better products. And I'm 100% sure that the interest for watches is going up, to be honest, because especially during COVID, we saw a lot of interaction. At the end of the day, people were bored also sitting at home, and then what they start researching stuff and they probably get into watches. So I don't worry about the Swiss watch industry. What I worry about is in case the industry goes back to overproduction again and commoditizing this beautiful hobby.
Yeah, I've heard you speak about this before, about a belief that fundamentally the industry just makes too much. Give us a percentage. What should the reduction in output be? Should it be at a set level, like it's the production of far too many under 5,000 Swiss franc watches, or is it right across the board? What's your kind of feel for it being right there in the heart of what
I think it's right across the board.
Right.
I mean, when you think about Rolex is producing 1 million watches, that's a lot of watches.
Yes.
And
they're expanding right now to build more.
It's a huge construction site here. Mm-hmm. I would say in general, we see more watch for the money. So I believe that in our position, we are very well positioned because the consumers they have time. They can read things. You guys are around. I mean, you can tell people when brands are selling bullshit.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't happen. So watchmaking pedigree and credibility in a brand should become more important, and people should look at that. And we have no problem with our movement, and we are happy to offer it to other brands who are serious about it. So perhaps more collaboration on that side, on a brand level, which would be very important, and I hope less holding obstacles, you know, less obstacles on from the big guys blocking the road on patents and stuff like that. That's not useful. It stifles innovation.
And is there anything you've seen during lockdown that's been particularly appealing to you from those watch brands that have continued? Like, is there anyone you think that's also dealt with the crisis particularly well?
Sure. I mean, I have to say Breitling did quite well. Yeah, I'm surprised. It was obviously a top management mindset change. Out of a sudden, the CEO shows up in social media and communicates directly. This was obvious. We did quite well, I say.
Yeah, but people are just taking not only things in their life as far as whether it's sport or diet or lifestyle, they're taking their hobbies more seriously and they have more time to get into the nitty gritty and to explore and to understand things that they had an interest of when their life was going 1 million miles an hour. They can now go into the details of what that is, and they have time now to dig through and to really double down on what's important.
Well, that's interesting, because what you've just said there, in the last couple of days, I've been speaking to not only new dealers, as in ADs here in Scotland, but also pre-loved, and they've said they've had one of the best years for watch sales throughout the COVID period. The way they said it was, perhaps people were going to go on a big holiday, and since they're not spending £5,000, £10,000 on something, they've instead decided to buy a watch, so they've got something on their wrist that they like and appreciate. And also the fact people have been at home, especially here in the UK, at 80% or 100% wage top-up, and they're getting paid to sit around doing nothing. So they don't have travel and other things, and to them, nothing has changed financially, so they're still buying watches, if not more, because they're not spending money on travel, and they're not going out the weekend to restaurants and nightclubs and things like that.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. What we can say in general is that the small brands, the very independent ones, the ones which are primarily consumer direct or online shop enabled, in general communicated much better than the big guys. Because for this type of company, and usually the younger generation, it's totally normal to use Instagram and to use Skype and whatever. We just extended what we anyhow use since 15 years. So they probably have also, the small brands have done quite well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the lifetime that it takes, you know, the timeline of producing a new watch, you know, many of these brands, despite the interruptions of maybe supply chain from the Far East, will have been in pre-plan long before lockdown happened, and they've managed to trickle them out. And because they've had a strong social media presence, they've managed to push sales.
By the way, I'm not so sure if the Far East argument is true.
In what way? In terms of the supply chain?
I mean, China relatively quickly went up and running from manufacturing point of view.
Oh.
So it was more in Europe. The guys who were in between an Asian factory mm-hmm. and a brand, trading guys and whatever, who were not really active. Or, you know, to be honest, I mean, a lot of European manufacturers are heavily dependent on Asian suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
So you reckon that there was a weakness in the market, but it wasn't because the Chinese warehouses weren't manufacturing. It was because the middlemen and middlewomen weren't able to move the stock around.
Or the brands or the factories in between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to be honest, do you really think all the Swiss-made cases come from Switzerland?
I think we all know.
I mean, how many people do live in Switzerland?
I think we all know what factory they come from in China.
or sapphire crystals.
Yes.
I mean, it's an incredible machine and labor-intensive business. Of course, there's some additional source. And a lot of factories have a second supplier, and which is totally okay. I mean, at the end of the day, it's only about the quality. Buy from the best source.
Well, something that people always kind of have their... There's two things, and these come along with speaking to you guys. The first thing, and I've made this comment many times, is people think making a tourbillon is a difficult thing. And when you guys were about to produce your own one, having designed two other movements, I was explaining that, well, you know, to move from a normal movement to a tourbillon isn't the biggest thing in the world. You've said their chronographs are much worse to sit down and try and plan. And the second thing is people always kind of poo-poo saying, oh, getting product from China. Well, the iPhone is made in China.
Yes.
You know, it's people have this disconnect.
I mean, a friend of mine, he is running the Apple watch case factory.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, 40,000 watch cases per day.
Wow.
Right.
I mean, that's a number.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be, you can't do that in the rice field.
Yes.
It's a highly equipped factory, super professional run. It's some of the best manufacturers in the world.
Yep, totally. Exactly. And people need to sort of just reconnect their brains a little bit and realize that even parts for Bentleys and all the highest grade cars in the world, aerospace parts, they come from China as well. You know, there's different variations.
I mean, I have to say, making movements is a Swiss thing.
Yes.
The Swiss are without doubt the best in that business. And I'm a German, you know, I have to accept that.
Grand Seiko may have something to say about that.
Japanese are seriously good. They are the only ones who can live up to the Swiss standard.
Yeah.
But Seiko and Citizen, they are doing their stuff by themselves.
Yeah.
So it's not like you have a country where you have a tightly knit supplier infrastructure where a bunch of smart engineers can really build a new movement like a tourbillon.
Mm-hmm.
Making that is difficult. Making that without suppliers is more or less impossible.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yes, the integration of it all and the knowledge network that exists in Switzerland, the over here it would be the old boys club type stuff, the school tie brigade. It's the same thing, but in the Swiss watch industry, everybody knows everybody. And you know the guy or the girl who's the expert on just that little thing that you need solved, just that little part that you need manufactured or honed in some way, shape or form. As opposed to great big integrated manufacturers such as you would have in the likes of Seiko, Grand Seiko, etc.
Excellent. Cool. Alrighty. Well, as we round things off, because we're coming to the close, do you guys want to give us a fluffy roadmap of how you see things sort of unfolding with Arage? Don't have to give us specific dates or months. Well, you could if you want, but tell us, you know, when's this coming out? When's that coming out? What's the ETA? Well, let's not say that. When is the time of the tourbillon? When is that likely to be coming out?
No, don't work either.
There's a few things going on, so the first thing that's probably going to be coming up, they'll be communicating very shortly, next week actually. I'm not sure when this podcast will come out, but mid-October we will be launching the second round of our pre-order. That'll enable people to take part, pre-order these watches that they've been waiting for. We wanted to really make sure that we had a large chunk of the engineering and development narrowed down before we actually stepped into opening up the second pre-order, because making sure that we can deliver when we say we deliver is very, very important, because we all know in the Swiss watch industry that, that people are used to long waits, and we don't want to keep our fans waiting and our supporters waiting. So we'll be launching the second round of the pre-order October, November. We'll start with K2, and K2 will be a multi-year project, going from a movement start into a watch that we'll be producing. And as we mentioned earlier, that there'll be a few different watches for people to vote on, or a couple of different watches that will actually go into production. Mm-hmm. We have another watch that is in the making right now, which is very, very special. It's one of one, and it's our diamond watch project. And it's a 15-carat diamond watch that's made with pure diamonds, which are CBD, lab-grown diamonds. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's very, very unique. And we're going to be launching that at some point. It's one of one, so it'll go to one lucky individual. That will be coming up in a couple of, probably in the next 4 months. And as we look into, 2021, we'll have some more exciting news and some other things to announce around K2 and other watch projects in the works. So
excellent.
What we have going on?
Just kind of the diamond. So are the diamonds being used as jewels in the watch movement, or it's
embezzled?
We
have girls in the team,
right? Okay,
and they need something for the soul. Not always that movement
careful,
stuff.
Andy,
you know, they need something which sparkles and which glitters. And we did this research long time ago and on lab cultivated diamond technology. And we are pretty knowledgeable in this field. And we didn't like the dirty story of regular diamonds. And so let's say, okay, we deep dive into this technology and make an incredible, cool product.
Cool. So it's going to be a diamond encrusted watch in some way, shape, or form. Diamonds are part of the case, and
yes, there's
Need sunglasses.
You'll need sunglasses. There's 108 diamonds in this watch.
Well, baguette diamonds.
Baguette,
not exactly the cheapest stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good stuff.
Interesting.
Cool.
Good. Right, Rick. Well, do you want to bring the show to a close?
Well, I will bring. I just wanted a quick question about something which we've touched on in a previous podcast. So you guys entered, was it the first time you'd entered GPHG, the Watch Oscars?
Oh, yeah.
No, third time.
Third time. And you were roundly...
But we probably will never get nominated.
Well, I wanted to say, so you put in your Tourbillon watch. It was the Petit Aiguille class, which is the less than 10,000 Swiss francs class, I think.
Yeah.
Which just shows you how competitive this Tourbillon's going to be. And you seem to have been rejected in favour of a Bell & Ross that you can see through, a Breitling that someone's broken out the colouring box for, a watch with a cartoon character on it, and the most indescript IWC known to man. Okay, the Habering has value, as does the Trilobe. So what do you guys think you're going to have to do to actually get the rest of the world, or those that like voting for Breitling, the big boys, to actually...
You know, there's two sides of a business. There's a real business.
Mm-hmm.
There's marketing and there's innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're in an industry that's forgotten innovation. That's the unfortunate case that we're up against, is that to truly understand what we're doing from a brand perspective, you have to dive into the details and
yes.
to really, I guess, open up your eyes and read and understand that what we're doing is innovative. And I mean, no offense to any of the other watches that were nominated. They all are nice looking watches. But when you go beyond skin deep, that's where you find what's really happening in the watchmaking industry. And it'd be nice if the GPHG would actually take into consideration or open up an innovation element within those different categories and allow brands to be noticed there.
I think badly needed would be consumer voting.
Yeah, I think, maybe we'll just launch our own awards.
Let's do that.
Yeah, I think it's not a complicated thing to do. So why not?
No, but I'm really surprised. I mean, I have handed in three times these applications, mm-hmm. and you think about what you write there. And then at the end of the day, you think about, shit, anyhow, nobody is reading that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Of all, I mean, I know we've got you on the show and we've become reasonable friends over a period, but I was absolutely stunned that considering the price you're submitting a Swiss-made tourbillon watch with your own silicon technology in it, in-house, and it's not getting a look-in from, to my mind, I don't know how many of the judges either simply just didn't read the application. So yeah. I think we need to start a campaign to get me and Ricky as judges. We'll vote for you. We can be bought.
Yeah, you read that stuff. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's also surprising. Mm-hmm. Or just some people are pissed.
Yes, yes, yeah. That's another character.
I mean, we're not the most popular guys in the watching industry. Let's be honest.
Okay, well, from the not the most popular guys in the watch podcasting industry to the not the most popular guys in the watch industry, thank you very much for joining us today. All the best. We will no doubt be in touch soon. Where should folk go to check out all things Orage?
Oh, Orage.com, Orage.info. You can get there either way. And
Orage Swiss, Facebook, Instagram.
Yep. We're on all the
good stuff.
Social channels there.
So go and check them out there. And obviously for all things Scottish watches, go and just Google Scottish watches. In particular, go and check out our Scottish Watches YouTube channel, where you'll find a talk show that was done with Landon and Andy a few months ago. And also check out Scottish Watches Live on a Friday. We recorded one a few weeks ago with Landon. And that's it. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from all of them.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh.